Our last speaker is Anant Bhave. He's one of the interventional radiologists at our hospital. And I picked him because one day one of our residents sheared off a part of a central line catheter and it was left in the patient's heart. And I thought sure it was going to be a giant problem. But Anant took it out. And the interventional radiologists, as we all know, are the people who keep surgeons out of trouble and get us out of trouble. So thank you for coming, Anant.
Thanks, Peter. How do I get out of this? Escape? Okay. All right, thank you. So, no disclosures for me. I'm going to talk about radiology and IR considerations for foreign body removal. The types of foreign bodies that we remove tend to be, as Peter said, intravascular is the vast majority of them. Catheter fragments are the vast majority of those. And those are usually secondary to some kind of pinch off or mechanical stress to a previously placed chest port or tunneled catheter, but they can be iatrogenically introduced as well. We do take out IVC filters. Intentional removal is a lot more common than if they migrate or are misplaced. And then embolized foreign bodies are usually sequelae of catheter-directed procedures such as guide wires, microcoils, or stents. And these tend to be things that we do ourselves and are intra-procedural, but we do take outside referrals. And then we take out extravascular soft tissue, foreign bodies, needles, birth control devices, broken JP drains, catheter cuffs, et cetera. And then other really rare things, biliary stents, Foley catheters, migrated renal stents. What are our clinical considerations for intravascular foreign body removal? Coagulopathy and anticoagulation is really important because we usually need to put in a pretty large sheath to take out the catheter. We have to snare them and kind of double them up on themselves typically. We do cause arrhythmias, particularly in the ones that are sitting next to the RA or the RV or have gone into the pulmonary artery. Sporadic ectopy is very, very common. Sporadic or sustained VTAC is common with septal irritation. Luckily, sporadic is much more common than sustained. And then the thing that we fear the most is right bundle branch block. And so if a patient has pre-existing left bundle branch block, we can put them into complete heart block. And so patients where we have to go into the pulmonary artery will typically do an EKG to make sure they don't have left bundle. PE is a possible complication. The thrombus on the catheter or the catheter fragment itself can travel to the pulmonary artery as we're trying to snare it. For access, we typically use the femoral vein or internal jugular vein. We can use subclavian or arm veins if those are occluded. And then arterial access is dependent on where the foreign body is located. The devices that we like to use include snares, and those are the most common. We can use curved or pigtail catheters to displace the catheter or foreign body away from the wall to where the snare will work. We often use baskets, forceps, or tip deflecting wires as well. For intravascular foreign bodies, we tend to have a very high success rate and luckily low associated morbidity. Here's a case of a guide wire lost during central line placement. As you can see, the tip of the wire is in the common iliac vein. The upper edge of the wire you can't see here. So we decided on a right common femoral vein approach to try and take it out. Here's a tip deflecting wire that we're using to kind of peel the edge of the wire away from the wall. And then we're able to snare it, pull it into our sheath, and now the wire is gone and our sheath remains. And we pull that out subsequently. Here's a case of a fractured chest port catheter. And this fractured at the typical location for pinch off or shear syndrome, right where the catheter passes underneath a clavicle and a subclavian port. So we took the port out in a normal manner. And to take out the catheter fragment, we used, again, a right common femoral vein approach. Here's our sheath and guide wire up. Grab it with a snare, and out it comes. This is a catheter that's made it all the way to the pulmonary artery. So we typically like to grab the free end of a catheter using a snare. However, in this case, the tips of the catheter are in small branches of the pulmonary artery. So we can't really use a snare to grab this out. You can't snare a looped end. It'll just slip out of the snare. So we use a pigtail catheter. You can imagine now the intraventricular septum is somewhere around here. This is the pulmonary outflow tract. You can imagine why we can irritate the septum and cause ectopy. We use the pigtail we spin the pigtail around the loop, and then we drag it down so that the tip is down in the IVC. Now the catheter extends from the pulmonary outflow tract through the RV, RA, into the IVC. Again, we use a loop snare to grab it and pull it out. Here's a case of a fractured chest port catheter during removal. This was not your typical pinch-off syndrome. We actually put a wire in when we realized that the catheter was fractured. This is actually a catheter that's been in for 9 years, and it's stuck to the brachiocephalic vein. So we, in the process of pulling the chest port out, we just used the go-ahead-and-pull-harder approach, and it broke. So we had to retrieve it. So we're in the common femoral vein approach again. We snare it, and our fellow says, it's hard to get out, and we said, okay, just pull harder. So we pull harder. We thought we had it out. We were wrong. We fractured the catheter. So you can see that there's a portion that's still stuck in the brachiocephalic vein, and we've embolized a piece of the catheter into the left pulmonary artery base. So in this case, we went in and we did grab the portion that was up here. This was in a very distal branch, and the pulmonary arteries are fragile. This was an elderly patient and asymptomatic, so we kind of had a long discussion with her and decided not to take it out. Saw her in clinic about a month later, and she remained asymptomatic, so we left it in there. It wasn't an easy decision to make, but that's what we decided to do. Here's an embedded IVC filter. So this should have been a routine removal of the filter. You can see our IVC gram. The tip of the filter looks like it might just be kind of tilted and sitting up against the wall of the IVC. In this case, when we do a more extensive IVC gram, you can see the tip is actually embedded in the wall of the IVC. And as you can imagine, we couldn't get the loop snare around it. So we tried our usual methods of getting a wire through there and trying to get the loop snare around that way. Those were unsuccessful. So in this case, we had to use a forceps removal. So in this case, it's a big sheath. It's a 16 French sheath. And we put in a forceps to actually grab the filter and rip it off the wall of the IVC and then pull it into the sheath. So these are patients that even if they're on anticoagulation, we usually convert them to Lovenox, have them hold the Lovenox the day of the procedure, and then restart it after we do the IVC gram after we pull the filter out to make sure there's no lacerations. And we do occasionally see lacerations where we have to hold their anticoagulation for a couple of days or so. Here's a case of one of my colleagues doing an embolization of an AVM coming off the posterior tibial artery. Here's a sort of demagged view. You can see the AVM. Here's the catheter in the AVM, and my colleague did a good embolization, put some particles in there, and started to sort of try to finish up and deployed. Why am I keep doing this? Deployed a coil. Sorry. And then the second coil deployed in the posterior tibial artery. So the posterior tibial artery in this case is 2 or 3 millimeters in diameter. So luckily for us, we have microsnare devices. These devices are normally intended to go grab wayward coils in the brain from aneurysms coilings, but we get to use them once in a while as well. So in this case, he's procured the coil, he's dragging it into the sheath, and now it's into the sheath and out. So it's a microsnare removal of a coil that we embolized, basically. This is a bit of an eye test. This patient has a retained endoscopic stent. This is a stent extending from the right biliary tree, and the distal end of it ends up somewhere above the ampulla. So and it was occluded. It had been placed in the Philippines, and it had been in for a couple of years, and the right lobe biliary tree was occluded. So in this case, we used a balloon to push the stent into the duodenum. And here's a loop snare, and we're able to maneuver the loop snare around the tip of the stent and pull it out. Now the biliary stent is out. Another case of a stuck Foley catheter. This is a frequent flyer in our ER. He's a prisoner that tries to make excuses to leave the hospital. He had stuck, this is a sagittal view, he'd stuck something in the balloon port of the Foley catheter, and here's the inflated balloon. So our urology colleagues tried a bunch of wires and things like that from a retrograde manner and were unable to get that freed up. So we brought him down to IR, and we used an ultrasound and a needle to actually stick the balloon of the Foley catheter and deflate it and then pull it out. So we did this with minimal sedation, so hopefully he won't be back. Here's a retained birth control implant. This had been put in a couple of years previously, and our OB-GYN colleagues were unable to palpate it, And so they sent the patient to us. So a little bit of local lidocaine, a small incision, and we were able to grab it and pull it out. Next, and this is the last case, I got permission from Peter to show this, even though it's not really a retained foreign body. This is dropped gallstones with abscess after cholecystectomy. You can see inside the abscess where the arrows are, those are the dropped gallstones. So in this case, on ultrasound, you can see the bilobed nature of the abscess cavity. And we put a drain in, and these are probably the stones. We're able to put a drain in percutaneously, brought the patient back a couple weeks later after the abscess had resolved, and we pulled the catheter out over a guide wire, put in a big sheath. This is about a 20 French sheath, and this is a terrible image, but this is a basket. So we used a basket to take out the gallstones within the cavity, and no residual stones. We put them on a Petri dish, and a couple of the stones are radio opaque. A couple of them, they're here and here, were not as radio opaque, so it would have been difficult to see without the sort of negative effect of the contrast. You can see the contrast is outlining the stones. These were not visible under fluoroscopy, so we needed a cavity in order to be able to see them and pull them out. So a couple weeks later, we brought them back, did a tube check, no more stones, and we took the tube out, and we were able to avoid any big surgery for this patient. So, summary, our removal of intravascular and soft tissue foreign bodies is something we do common enough, it's relatively routine, and it's safe if we observe the basic precautions that I talked about. Removal of other types of foreign bodies is unusual for us, and is usually possible. I'll rephrase that and say sometimes possible, but it requires consultation and more extensive planning. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all the speakers, and now we're going to have a panel discussion. Please feel free to come up to the microphones and ask any questions. Dr. Colburn will lead that panel discussion.
Yes, please, in the front. Thank you.
Thank you for the panel. My name is Zia Bagmanle. I'm the general surgeon in Red Buddy, Illinois. My question is the case question. The patient comes in with the ingested foreign body. He says that he was eating some chicken and something got stuck in his esophagus that's clear by his salivation and everything. Then he got an X-ray, CT scan, shows no perforation, and endoscopy shows that the piece of bone got stuck in the mid to lower esophagus, kind of T-boned in the both ends and embedded into the mucosa for sure. You gently try to mobilize it, and it's stuck. What would be your approach to get it out?
Who'd like to handle it?
This would be the pull slightly harder approach.
Pull harder, okay.
I think as long as you're convinced that it hasn't gone through the esophagus, there are a couple of case reports of these bones penetrating into vascular structures, and when you pull them out, you get this torrential hemorrhage. But you've done a CAT scan, it's nothing, it's not even outside the wall of the esophagus, it's just embedded in the mucosa. So I think you can put an overtube and then get the overtube almost all the way up to the bone and then put a forcep or a snare and then see if it'll come through.
So is there any concern about just because it's embedded in both sides, if you try to pull one side, it can push into the other side?
Usually not. I think if you grab it and pull it directly towards the, if you have an overtube right on top of it, it'll almost collapse into the overtube and then you can get it out. That's something that we do often with foreign bodies is we'll put the overtube almost up to the foreign body and then try and pull the foreign body into the overtube. And once you've got that, then you can pull the endoscope, the overtube, and the foreign body out all in one piece. And that usually works out.
Yes.
At what point would you dilate a stricture if you're scoping them for a food bolus? Would you do it then, or would you wait some period of time?
The only problem of dilating at that time is usually the esophageal mucosa is macerated in edematous, and you really don't get a good feel of what the true diameter of the stricture is. I try not to dilate it at that time, and I usually will bring the patient back, leave them on PPIs for a few days, and then bring them back and then dilate up the esophagus. If you have any concern that this may be eosinophilic esophagitis, and the clue to that would be the esophageal lumen looks, you know, people describe as a feline esophagus. It looks like a stack of coins. It'd be very important to do a biopsy and then know whether that patient has eosinophilic esophagitis or not, because for whatever reason, these patients are very vulnerable to perforations from dilation, and PPIs and then swallowed or steroids seem to work very well in these patients. So if you have the opportunity to get that additional piece of information, that would be very useful to determining how much you're going to dilate them the next time around.
Are most food bolus-related obstructions due to an existing stricture, or can you swallow a big enough chunk of food that even with a normal esophagus you'll obstruct?
You can almost certainly swallow a big enough piece that it'll just obstruct. Mm. And in about 25-30% of cases, we won't find an underlying cause. We don't send all these patients for motility testing, but you know, some patients just take too big a bite.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Good afternoon. How do you feel about laparoscopic combined with fluoroscopic for metallic colonic foreign bodies? For example, I had a case of a child that had swallowed a needle, and we were observing it for a couple of days, just like you did in that case that you put, but then just wouldn't move, and then we ended up going laparoscopically. And under fluoroscopic guidance, it's able to like hold that area of the bowel and bring it up and open it and get it out. But how do you, what do you feel about using that method?
That sounds like a very appropriate method. I guess my question is, if it's already gotten all the way to the colon, potentially, is what are the chances that it's going to continue to get out of the body without any issue? So I would wait and keep a close eye on them.
Right. We waited about 2 days, and it appeared as if it was like getting stuck just at that in the cecum, and I was worried about, because there's a needle that it would perforate. So
my residents put needle holes in the cecum all the time. And I correct them, but I haven't had anyone die from that yet.
You would wait a week? Like, how long would you wait?
I would wait as long as until the patient can't take it or I can't take it anymore.
Right.
And it sounds like a very kind of a slick technique to do that.
Right. Okay. And don't forget about endoscopic removal. Yeah. If it's in the cecum, you have colonoscopic approach, and I would certainly take that as a first approach before I would do a laparoscopic approach and put a hole in the cecum.
Right.
Yes, sir. Okay.
I'm Blake Butler from Beatrice, Nebraska. Let's say a patient swallows a coin-type battery and he gets out of the stomach into the small bowel. Can we wait until that passes, or do we have to explore him?
I think you can wait till it passes. Once it's down in the small bowel, you can wait, but you need to follow them closely and make sure it continues to move along.
Thank you.
Do you agree?
I haven't seen that case yet, but I know that coin-type batteries really scare me. I had one. I know in the esophagus they can be quite caustic, and I'm more aggressive with the coin-type batteries if they end up. Usually they don't get that far because we're so aggressive about those batteries that it'd be rare to get down there. But I don't know. I don't know the data on that. So.
I think you also have to realize that finding a coin-type battery in the small intestine is not going to be an easy task. It's a little thing, and it's going to be hard to palpate, and you might be in the operating room for quite a while trying to find that and remove it.
Thank you.
Is there a question right there?
Yeah, Carl, yes, Paperniak from New Ulm, Minnesota. Some of my emergency room colleagues, when there's a food bolus caught, have been trying the cosmic candy that produces CO2 to push it through. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
You know, I don't have any personal experience with it, but if it prevents a gastroenterologist from having to come in the middle of the night, I say why not?
How about perforations?
I haven't heard of perforations from that. I can't imagine you'd generate enough force with the CO2 that's producing that would perforate.
Question in the back?
Yeah. What's the best imaging modality to visualize glass?
To visualize?
Glass.
Did you understand?
Glass.
Glass? Yeah. Okay. Visualizing glass by imaging criteria?
CT.
CT?
Yeah, I think CT, yeah.
CT. The consensus is CT.
But I think you could try ultrasound depending on where it is, right? I think it's appropriate to try at least with the ultrasound. If it's visible, then you have your answer.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, we're about 2 minutes shy of our appointed adjournment time, so we'll go ahead and wrap it up. And thank you all very much for joining us today.